There are a few subjects that our society does not seem to like talking about, and it is certainly understandable with sexual assault because it's a horrible thing for any person to do to any other. But it needs to be talked about, to be better understood, to be prevented. Our guests this hour deal with sexual assault from a couple of different angles. Winnie M. Lee wrote a novel about sexual assault, but it is a story very similar to what happened to Winnie in real life. The book is called Dark Chapter. Winnie joins us by phone from London. Winnie, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
And we also have with us to talk about sexual assault responses in our own region, Susan Moen, the executive director of Jackson County SART, the Sexual Assault Response Team. She's in the studio with me. Susan, good to see you.
Good morning.
And Bibi Beltran joins us as well. She's the executive director of a very similar program, the Sexual Assault Support Services of Lane County, abbreviated to SASS Lane. Bibi Beltran, thank you for joining us. I want to start with Winnie Lee. Talk about the decision to go public with the story of being raped and to write about it and how this all crystallized for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, well, first of all, I've always been a writer. So my rape took place 10 years ago when I was 29, and I was pretty much a fully formed adult by that point. And writing had always been my way of, I guess, making sense of the world and of things that happened to me. So it was pretty much impossible for me to live through something this life-changing and not try to write about it. So that's one thing. I've always been a writer. The other thing is, bizarrely, in my own rape was very widely reported in the local media. It took place in Northern Ireland outside Belfast. So within hours of my rape, it was actually all over the news because police were looking for my perpetrator. And then 2 days later, I found myself, you know, Googling my own rape. I suppose I'm a curious person like that, right? And I found all these news stories about my rape, and I even listened to a half-hour radio chat show in Northern Ireland about my rape. Did that mean if Belfast was a safe city? So it was incredibly weird to be listening to complete strangers talking about my rape when it was something that was incredibly personal and private to me and also life-changing. And I just, on some level, I felt like, well, if there's anyone in this world that has the right to tell my story, that's probably me. So even though at the time I was incredibly traumatized and it took me a good few years to recover from that assault, at the back of my mind I always knew I wanted to be able to tell my story in my own terms. And for me that meant writing about it as fiction in this book, in Dark Chapter.
In Dark Chapter, the book begins with Vivian, the protagonist, telling her story for what feels like the millionth time to a therapist, a counselor.
Yeah.
I mean, it's portrayed as a necessary evil, but which raises the question, was the process of writing the book therapeutic for you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask me that. I mean, I have to stress, it was important for me to recover from the trauma before I was able to be at a point in my life where I had the perspective to write about it as fiction. So I didn't actually start writing it until about 5.5 years after my rape, even though shortly after the assault I knew I did on some level want to write about it, but I knew it just wasn't at the right point. However, I guess, so yeah, I did, in the process of recovering, there were endless times where I had to share my experience to therapists, then also to the criminal justice system, and also to doctors, even just getting the support I needed with specialist services, which I'm sure we'll probably get back to that later on in the conversation, involved having to tell my story over and over. So it was incredibly exhausting on one hand. And yet, on the other hand, none of that was a particularly artistic way of telling my story. So I guess for me, by writing the book and by imagining my perpetrator as one of the protagonists in that story, because that's truth. I mean, the crime wouldn't have happened without him. I, in some ways, was at least able to put to rest a lot of questions I had about my own rape and about him and why he did something like that. And if he ever thought about the impact of his actions on my life and what had happened in his life that had led him to committing that crime against me. So I can't say it was, I mean, therapeutic in that it resolved me of all my problems, because I pretty much had to recover from the trauma largely before I wrote the book. But it did allow me to resolve some questions, at least in my mind or through my imagination, that I had about my perpetrator.
So Susan Moen at Sexual Assault Response Team in Jackson County, tell us about the services you provide and how you respond to people who've been in situations like what Winnie was in.
Sure. So we're a nonprofit, and we run a couple of services that are acute. So for survivors who are assaulted, within 7 days, we have a sexual assault nurse examiner program where a survivor can go to any of our county hospitals and get care, forensic exam, and evidence collection if they wish. The main goal of that is just for somebody to come in and get checked out, make sure they're okay, and be able to talk about options. And that's one-on-one with a sane nurse and a community works advocate.
Sane meaning sexual assault nurse examiner.
Yes, okay. Exactly. And the goal there is to have everything that the survivor does be one-on-one with somebody who is specially trained, as opposed to just be part of the general hospital response. And then we also run support groups, free support groups, drop-in. We have general support groups. We have one specific for LGBTQ folk. And we just started one specific to teen survivors who can come even if they have not reported, because that support group is led by non-mandatory reporters.
Interesting. So it sounds like there are some loopholes or workarounds you have to deal with because of the mandatory reporting?
Yeah. So, you know, somebody who's a mandatory reporter, if a survivor who is under the age of 18 or several other vulnerable classes came in and disclosed, that would have to be reported to law enforcement. Well, we have folks who might not be ready for that report yet. So working with a non-mandatory reporter means they have the opportunity to explore what the options are, get themselves safe and in a space where they can look at if they want to report or not. Reporting is a really good thing, and it is not appropriate for everyone. Not everyone is going to want or even be able to report, and certainly not always right away.
Bebe Beltran, in about a minute, can you tell us about the services at SAS Lane?
Sure, I can certainly try. Similar to Jackson County SART, SAS is a nonprofit. We, for the most part, are not mandatory reporters. We do have one counselor on staff, but we are really forthcoming with their mandatory reporting obligations ahead of time so that doesn't get initiated without the survivor's consent. So we have a 24-hour crisis and support line. We do 24/7 emergency medical response, so that looks like us presenting to the ER. If a patient should indicate at any time that they have been sexually assaulted, we are contacted. We do a drop-in center, so somebody can come to our office and meet with an advocate to discuss whatever they want to discuss that day without an appointment. We have support groups. We have several support groups for self-identified females over the age of 18. We have a support group for self-identified males over the age of 18. We do a drop-in support group for the LGBTIQA+ community.
Okay. Let me get the rest of the list in just a moment. Bebe Beltran, Susan Moe, and Winnie Lee, hang on. We'll come back and talk more about sexual assault on the Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. The topic today is sexual assault, an issue we don't particularly want to talk about in society, but clearly need to because it continues to happen. And the better we talk about it, the more we talk about it, the better perhaps we understand why it comes about and how to deal with it. Our guests include Winnie Lee, the author of a book, Dark Chapter, which is really a fictionalized account of her own rape in Belfast, Northern Ireland, 10 years ago. We also have with us Susan Moen, the executive director of the Sexual Assault Response Team, or SART, in Jackson County, and Bebe Beltran, who is the executive director of Sexual Assault Support Services of Lane County, or SAS Lane. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3600. 760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Bebe, I'm sorry I had to shorten your list up a little bit there. Continue on with the things you provide at SAS Lane.
Sure. Thank you so much. So as far as support groups go, like I said, we have different groups for self-identified females over the age 18, self-identified males over the age 18, support groups for LGBTIQA+, and then we also do a support group for the Latinx community, which is facilitated all in Spanish. And that's a project with Centro Latino Americano, which is a culturally specific agency in our community. We also do community outreach and education with all sorts of different groups, and we also provide free counseling services.
So let me ask you first, of the three of you, have we reached a point in time when we talk about sexual assault more frankly?
Yes and no, depending on the day and depending who you ask. I think that the Me Too movement has given a lot of awareness on this issue, although for those of us in the field, this isn't exactly new. It happens all the time, but I think the fact that we're talking about it more has raised it into the public consciousness that we are actually talking about the underlying conditions that allow it to continue and to be so pervasive.
Winnie Lee, I mean, you were already working on the book before the Harvey Weinstein revelations and things like that. So did you feel like the book sort of burst with the same wave or something?
I guess so. I mean, my book came out in the UK in June, and then it came out in the US in September, and then within a month of it coming out is when the first Weinstein revelations came out. So in some ways, I think my book has definitely benefited from, I suppose, an increased interest in issues of sexual assault, you know, and gender inequality. And certainly I've been invited to a lot of different kind of panel discussions and, you know, and festivals where there's always, you know, where the programmers make sure to have something in place that addresses this issue. So, I mean, I'm obviously grateful for the fact that there's this increased interest because of these revelations and the ongoing revelations in Hollywood and elsewhere. But I also feel, you know, as Bibi said, that this is not a new story. I mean, like, sexual assault and rape have been taking place since all of, you know, human history. So, I mean, it's good that finally it's starting to be a little bit more recognized as a problem. But I think we're hopefully just at the beginning of a conversation. But yeah, I mean, certainly I appreciate the fact that my book kind of chimes in with what a lot of other people are thinking about at the moment.
Help us understand again that the publicity about your real life rape. Why was that so public at the time?
I don't know. I mean, and that's an important question because, like, why is rape on one hand something we don't speak about very frequently, and yet it's sort of all over the news at the same time? You know, certainly, for example, Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein. I mean, there's a certain kind of salaciousness about rape, a certain kind of, you know, sensationalism, which the media loves, right? And so that's kind of a lot of the work that I do as an activist and also as an academic researcher, because on one hand, it's very visible. On the other hand, you're not getting actually the real stories and certainly the experiences of survivors being heard in the media. So I think, you know, it's the same reason that you see, you know, sexual violence in Game of Thrones so much, or in so much movies or television. There's this kind of bizarre fascination with sexual violence in a way that, you know, doesn't really do justice to the survivor's experience. But I think that's one of the reasons why my own rape was so widely reported. It was, I mean, the headline said, you know, I'm of Chinese descent, so the headline in Northern Ireland said, Chinese tourist raped by 15-year-old boy in the woods, right? I mean, so that kind of fits not every single stereotype, but it certainly fits the stereotype we have of rape, which is that it's something that happens, you know, in a scary forest, which a stranger jumps out, you know, at a poor woman, right? But in reality, actually, most victims aren't attacked by somebody by a stranger. They're attacked by someone they know. So there's this bizarre gap between the lived reality of sexual violence and the way it's often reported in the media.
Well, then that brings us back to a point that Susan Mullen made a couple of minutes ago when you said that something, I forget exactly how you phrased it, but that a lot of people don't want to report what happened to them. And is it often because it is a non-stranger situation, Susan?
Yeah, I mean, the barriers to reporting are huge. And if you think about in public cases, what we see in the media, the way that, you know, if a case is going through the judicial process, the way that the victim is treated, the survivor is treated, that's enough to, I think, scare a lot of people off. And sometimes, like with the Weinstein, you know, there we had people who had this enhanced credibility because of, you know, being famous movie stars and things like that as a start. And so I think folks who feel like they are not in that class of having instant credibility, the barriers to coming forward are profound and huge. And also, you know, there's so many complications if you've been harmed by somebody that you know, you still have a connection to them emotionally. You might not even want to get them in trouble. You certainly fear that you won't be believed and that perpetrators, friends, and family members will come after you. Backlash. I see that a lot in the high school age cases where, if you can imagine what it would be like to come forward and say a fellow student, you know, did this. Or we've had, you know, cases where teachers were preying on their students, and imagine what it would be like for a student to come forward and say, this beloved teacher, you know, has done this to me, and really fear that they wouldn't be believed.
Which falls right into the category of the email we got from Pat in Ashland, who writes, I have recently had a close friend to get sexually assaulted. The culprit was not prosecuted by my school because there was not enough physical evidence. He was fired, but he plans to work with children and high schoolers for a living. How can young women be expected to produce physical evidence for something so traumatic? And is there any alternative for the brave young women who choose to stand up for themselves? Bibi Beltran, can you take that one?
Well, I actually think that physical evidence is a misnomer. So, you know, you hear all the time that survivors should do X, Y, and Z after they're assaulted. They should go to the hospital, and they should have forensic evidence collected, and that will prove something. But what DNA evidence, the presence of DNA evidence proves is that something sexual happened, but it doesn't prove consent or lack of consent. So I think that that's tough, and that's a tough burden to put on survivors. I think that there has to be more credibility given to survivors' own personal accounts, and it shouldn't be a he said, she said, or they said situation. It's not just physical evidence. It's everything else that led up to it. You know, was it an accident that this person who has power over the survivor, you know, got them alone or was able to take advantage of the situation? So there's more to it than just the physical aspect of it.
So you and Winnie had both mentioned the term credibility now. Is that often an issue, Bibi?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We know that perpetrators, they're smart, first of all, you know, smart in a very devious way, and they have criminal thinking, so that they choose survivors or folks to victimize who are vulnerable, accessible, and lacking credibility, or can be perceived to be lacking credibility. So a lot of times it has to do with age of the person. It has to do with whether or not they ingested some type of substance, you know, either surreptitiously or voluntarily. Heaven forbid somebody have a few drinks, you know, and then something like this happened to them. What I always tell people is that rape is not a natural consequence of drinking. It's not a natural consequence of anything, actually. So there's a lot of onus placed on survivors for something that they actually didn't do. They were just in the wrong place with the wrong person.
So much has been made, particularly in Oregon, about how rape kits, you know, the actual forensic tests post-sexual assault sat on shelves and didn't get tested for years and years. Are you saying that that is not as important as attaching some credibility to the people who report the rapes?
I think they're both important. I think the fact that Oregon kind of got itself in a situation where we had such a backlog is an indication that those who were investigating the crimes weren't necessarily thinking that the story of the allegations were credible. And so they were making the determination about what kits to send to the crime lab, you know, based upon their own personal experience and often bias. And so what we have come to now, which is a much better place, is that discretion is taken away from investigators, and now all the kits are just forwarded to the crime lab for processing.
Sexual assault, the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Bibi Beltran is the Executive Director of Sexual Assault Support Services of Lane County, or SAS Lane. Susan Moen runs a similar organization in Jackson County, Jackson County SART, Sexual Assault Response Team. Winnie M. Lee is an author on the line from London. She's written a novel called Dark Chapter that fictionalizes something that happened to her in real life. She had a stranger rape happen to her 10 years ago in Belfast. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Talk about the things that we need to talk about with sexual assault in our society to move ahead. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Winnie, you know, I kind of hesitated with how to word the question, but what were the things that helped you heal or recover, if those are even the correct verbs?
Yeah, I mean, no, those are the correct verbs. I mean, healing and recovering, that describes the process that I was able to go through after my own rape. I mean, I get asked this a lot. For me, it was the key to it was having a support network, right? So I actually, you know, I sound American. I am American. My parents live in California, and I live in London. So they're several time zones away from me, and I actually had an incredibly supportive network of friends who believed me and held me up in some ways. I actually didn't tell my parents for a number of years because I just felt like it'd be too much for them to bear in some ways, to have to bear when I was myself quite traumatized. So I told my friends right away, and part of that was because, you know, having my rape reported in the news so widely, I was like, this is a little bit, you know, I'm not being quite honest here if all of Belfast knows about my rape, but my own friends don't. So I told my friends right away, and I was lucky that they believed me right away. Part of that, again, is because it was a stranger rape, I think. So no one's going to say I'm making this story up about being randomly raped by a 15-year-old boy walking through a forest, right? So, my friends believed me right away, and they were incredibly helpful and supportive, right? So having that set of people believe me was really helpful. I also, you know, unfortunately, I didn't get the help of specialist support services in London. I kind of fell through the cracks administratively, and I just didn't end up really getting any help from specialist services. So I would have loved to have spoken to a BB or a Susan to have gotten that. But I think that obviously those support services are very helpful. And then for me, I did get incapacity benefit from the British government, which, you know, I mean, the UK has a bigger kind of safety, you know, social safety network there for people that have fallen on hard times. So I wasn't able to work anyway because of my PTSD and anxiety, and then not being able to work but still being able to get some money from the government certainly gave me the time to focus on healing and recovering as opposed to having to focus on earning money. So I was quite lucky, and I think if the same thing had happened in the U.S., I probably wouldn't have gotten that kind of funding that would have allowed me to focus on healing. So in some ways, those are all, yeah, the support of friends, that kind of federal support from the government was really helpful. But a lot of it was also just, you know, I didn't submerge my story. Part of that was because I had to, you know, it was all over the news, and I went straight into, you know, calling a friend who called the police. So there wasn't ever a moment of kind of denial and submerging the story. And I do know quite a lot of other survivors who it was years or months before they started to reckon with what had happened to them. So that's kind of a delay in the recovery process, I think. I mean, but I'd be curious to know if Susan or Bibi would think otherwise on that.
Let's hear what Susan thinks.
I think, you know, definitely for some folks, that ability to start addressing it right away is helpful. But we also see folks who just can't. And, you know, the response there is your body and your brain will let you address this when it can handle it. We know a lot more now about traumatic effect, how the brain responds to trauma. And so even just recovering memories can take a really long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, our goal is just to move with the survivor through their time frame. We certainly can suggest ways that they can start addressing it. But I find, for example, you know, forcing somebody to go to therapy because it's supposed to be good for them is not going to work. You know, having therapy be an option that they choose somewhere when it feels right is good. One thing that I've found is particularly for my teen survivors, we've found that body work has been a really great alternative beginning point for that healing process, where if they're not ready to sit, and I don't know if it's, you know, something about teens in general, but for those who aren't ready to sit and do talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, just working with a body worker who can kind of help them reclaim their body as their own and as a place of positive experience, that can be a really nice introduction into that healing process. But I think the main thing, and Bibi, you can chime in, is we're going to work with somebody in the way that they feel is going to be most useful. And we say, you know, your life will never be the same. This is your new normal, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be worse eventually, right? The healing process is very, very long for some folks, but it does happen.
So, Bibi, are there conflicting timelines there? I mean, do the police want to work fast, and that works against the survivor wanting more time?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that's a natural thing for folks who get into law enforcement. They want to, you know, have a safe community, right? So they want to remove folks who are doing harm to other folks in the community, which is a natural thing, which is, again, why they get into law enforcement. However, what we know about trauma and the brain and how we capture memories and how we're able to actually move forward and process information after a traumatic event is actually much different than what I would say folks intuitively believe to be true. So allowing time, allowing options, allowing it to be survivor-centered and survivor-driven is extremely important. And I feel like when you have a stronger survivor, you have a stronger case. So it benefits everybody if we want to create a safe community to allow survivors to really guide the process. So in Oregon, we have the ability for survivors who present to the emergency room or a medical facility for evidence collection to have evidence collected anonymously. So what that means is that they have a certain amount of time before they can actually change their mind and put their name to that report. So they're not losing any evidence. They're not losing any documentation about the fact that they received medical help in the aftermath of a traumatic event involving a sex act. But what they're doing is allowing some time so that they can actually think about what may happen, you know, as a result of this decision to go forward with reporting or not reporting. So I think that time is crucial, and it doesn't have to happen right away. You know, it's not like it is on TV. TV is wildly inaccurate. It's a form of entertainment, and unfortunately, many folks believe what they see on TV as to be how the systems really work.
So, as a survivor services deliverer, do you maintain an official neutrality? You know, it's your point completely whether you want to report or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We do not provide advice. We provide options. So we can work with a survivor about predicting and preparing. So if they want to go a certain outcome, then we can talk about potential, or if they want to go a certain way, we can talk about potential outcomes, what may happen. So it's all, you know, the whole point is to ensure that survivors have as much information as possible so that they can make a well-informed decision about their own situation, because they're the experts in the situation. They're the experts on their lives. They know what they can handle. And although that's uncomfortable sometimes for survivors who really just want somebody to tell them what to do, that's not our place. That's not an advocate's role. Again, it's about options.
So, Susan Millen, how long do you stay in touch with people who have used the services of SART? I mean, is it indefinite? Is it open-ended?
Yeah, it's definitely indefinite. You know, oftentimes when you'll be working towards specific goals in the beginning, like helping them find a counselor, walking them through the legal process, things like that. And then oftentimes the shift just becomes being there to hear things that they're encountering. A lot of times people are doing check-ins, like asking, is this normal, right? This is how I'm feeling. I have folks who I've stayed with for years and years. And so at some point it just becomes they are free to reach out whenever they want. And we usually ask them, would you like a check-in in a month, in a 6 months, things like that.
Susan Millen, B.B. Beltran, and Winnie M. Lee are guests on the Jefferson Exchange as we discuss sexual assault. Winnie M. Lee, the author of Dark Chapter, a novel that fictionalizes a rape that really happened to her in real life. Susan Millen, the executive director of Jackson County SART, the Sexual Assault Response Team. B.B. Beltran, the executive director of Sexual Assault Support Services of Lane County, SAS Lane. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more about sexual assault and what we do as a society to correct it. Join us on the Exchange when we return in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about sexual assault and the fact that we have to talk about it more in society because it still happens. It has been happening as long as there have been human beings. And we're seeing if we can bend that curve downward a little bit over time. Three guests with us, Winnie M. Lee, author and activist and film producer. She is the author of a novel called Dark Chapter, which is a fictionalized account of her own rape in Northern Ireland 10 years ago. Susan Millen, the executive director of Jackson County SART, the Sexual Assault Response Team. B.B. Beltran, the executive director of the Sexual Assault Support Services of Lane County, or SAS Lane. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. We're open to your phone calls and emails at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Susan was talking, Winnie, about the new normal, that it's not necessarily going to be worse, but your life is different. There's a moving portion in the front of your book where you talk about seeing your younger self across an abyss and wanting to shout something to your younger self. What would that have been?
Don't continue that hike, right? You know, and I think that's some. I mean, I was you know, raped while I was hiking on my own, and at the time, I just wanted to, you know, follow this trail, and I was completely blind to the danger that this one person posed to me. You know, I was talking to a teenage boy had approached me, asked for directions, and then he kept on following me, and I wasn't really aware of that. So I actually wrote that section just a few weeks after my assault, and, like, I don't know why I wrote it, but I think I was kind of looking back on those few moments and trying to warn myself. And I think that's something every survivor and victim does, because, you know, we're always asking questions like, how could I have let myself get into that situation? How could I have been, you know, that blind to the danger? And yet that's not, you know, I think there's this desire to kind of say that, you know, we could have avoided it some way. But, you know, as Bibi had mentioned, it, like, rape happens because you happen to cross paths with a perpetrator. I could have made every single decision I wanted and the next day cross paths with a different perpetrator. So that's the shocking thing, that it's something which is in some ways entirely out of your control. And, yeah, I think in this day and age we're told that, you know, we get what we deserve for our decisions, and that's not always the case, right? So I would have told her to kind of stop walking if she could have, and, you know, continue to hike another day. But at the same time, that's who I was. I loved hiking. I was able to reclaim hiking again in the wake of my assaults, and I'm pretty sure also if I was a man and I'd gone on that hike, you know, that wouldn't have happened to me. So, you know, what is it, the conclusion to draw from that? I should never go hiking again? I mean, no. So, you know, I think there's this sense of regret that a lot of survivors have about things they did that got them into that situation. But at the end of the day, it was never your fault to begin with. And I think that's the important thing to remember.
Now, one of the key choices you made in the novel was to give us some insides of Johnny, the rapist. And what did it take for you to as a creative person, imagine this person who is still a human but has still done a horrible thing?
I mean, I think I was trying to, on some level, explain why he did the things he did. And again, you know, I'm not excusing him for his actions in any way whatsoever, but he was 15 years old when he finally attacked and raped me. So I was trying to imagine what had happened in the 15 years of his life that had led him to being so violent at such a young age. And so, you know, in reality, I wasn't actually able to find out that much about the real-life person because the police kept on saying he had a right to privacy, which I understand. So I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to write this as fiction anyway so I can just imagine it. So for me, it was really about, okay, let's try to imagine this person from a very young age, from childhood. You know, I mean, nobody's born being a rapist, right, in some ways. So there's some kind of combination of chemicals and also outside influences and maybe, I don't really know, but there's a combination of things that leads to somebody being that violent at such a young age. So I was trying to imagine how he had grown up and what were his different influences. And at the same time, it was about how do I kind of take readers back to this being a human being that we could maybe on some level relate to. So I was trying to figure out ways to make him more relatable. So when he's growing up, he's admiring of his older brother and also resentful of when he's being ignored by his older brother. And, you know, when he's looking at the moonlight falling on the landscape, he appreciates that. So, and, you know, it's a decent sense of humor. So there's these things about being able to, like, have a sense of humor and appreciate the landscape and have these certain kinds of vulnerabilities that we can relate to that I wanted to establish for Johnny and yet also at the same time establish that, I mean, he made some pretty bad decisions, he had some pretty bad influences, and despite all that, you know, he still is a rapist, and he has to kind of face the consequences of that later on in his life.
Johnny's Belfast world is just, he's sort of steeped in toxic masculinity, and I wonder what we do in society to approach that, and I wonder if it's even part of the programs you run. Susan Mullen?
So we have, for example, a kindergarten through 12th grade sexual violence prevention program in the schools here in Jackson County. It's something that the state of Oregon has actually started to mandate under Aaron's Law. And one of the things when you enter into doing prevention work, you know, way back when I started out, it used to be about risk reduction, right? Teach people how to not get raped, which is really an incredibly offensive point of view. Because if you protect yourself, that just means the perpetrator is going to choose someone else, right? It doesn't actually address the level of perpetration. It just addresses an individual's, risk in that one moment. So if you move away from risk reduction, what we look at is what's called primary prevention, the idea that we need to change the entire culture because it's the culture that's basically allowing us all to say this level of gender violence is something we're willing to put up with and is acceptable and, you know, oh gosh, we can't really do that much about it. Anyway, and so changing that to a conversation of what can we do as individuals and as a society to remove the norms and to remove the way that our kids are socialized and our adults are socialized to make this not acceptable. And so that's where, you know, in the early grades, you're really talking to kids about body autonomy and space and consent in all sorts of ways, even in kindergarten. So just looking at those cultural pieces, and certainly, you know, in Winnie's book, some of the things that she's presenting there in the perpetrators growing up are these ideas of strong gender stereotypes. We know, you know, there are not a lot of things we know absolutely are causal factors for sexual violence, but offenders tend to have a sense of strong gender norms, like women are supposed to do this, men are supposed to do this, and they often have a really strong sense of entitlement, that they are owed something, and, you know, if they aren't given it, then they will take it. And so those are things, looking at those attributes and saying, where in our society can we start dismantling that sort of thing?
But Bebe Beltran, to some degree, I imagine you're working against people who do want to maintain the so-called gender norms. And in fact, I think it was a letter to the editor I saw recently in the Medford paper about somebody defending toxic masculinity itself because it's what you need when you're a soldier kicking in a door, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yes, I agree. I mean, you know, I think you need to meet people where they're at. And the truth is, there are some people I'm just not going to meet. You know, they're just never going to come to this recognition about the destructive nature of having toxic masculinity or misogyny. But I try not to focus on that group. I try to focus on the majority of people who are just unsure, right, who are unsure of why this happens or how often it happens, and really kind of talk about the conditions that allow it to exist, you know, the sense of entitlement that perpetrators feel, the sense that in dominant culture that sexual violence is normalized. Like, this is just what happens. This is just part of, like, your experience being a queer person, being a person of color, being a woman, being somebody who is a person with disabilities. Like, this is just, like, part of the norm, and you're just supposed to accept it. So changing that, you know, and holding offenders accountable for actions that they take is super important. And then I think, you know, when it comes to the folks who are enforcing our laws, that's huge, because I think about what happened in Stanford, you know, with Brock Turner. That whole situation, that's what an example of when the system worked perfectly, right? It worked perfectly. Like, there were witnesses, there was immediate aftercry, arrest, and then what happened? You know, went to trial, was convicted in, what, 6 months? So that type of thing.
And the judge has since been recalled, though.
Right, yeah, but still, like, that happened. Mm-hmm. That happened, you know, in this day and age when you know, folks would like to think that we're more progressive and that we kind of think that sexual violence shouldn't happen, but we allow it to happen because offenders see this and they're like, well, if it does happen, in the slim chance that I do get caught and convicted or, you know, go to trial, then I may get a slap on the wrist. There's too much weight put on the impact that being convicted of a crime has on the offender with little regard to the impact that this crime has on the survivor. So until that goes away, we're not going to see, I think, the offender accountability that I would like to see.
Winnie Lee, I want to ask about your research into social media by rape survivors to share their experiences. I understand this is the bulk of your PhD research at the London School of Economics. How have people used social media to share their experiences?
Well, I think the example that Bebe provided, the case against Brock Turner at Stanford, was a perfect example, right? Because one of the reasons that blew up and was had such a big impact around the world was because that victim impact statement was circulated by BuzzFeed. And I think, you know, the last time I checked, it had been read by 30 million people. I'm sure it's been more since then. That's a 10,000-word statement, right? So it's a very, very long statement that no newspaper would ever publish. I mean, that no print newspaper would ever publish because it just takes too much space, right? And yet, at the same time, it, you know, because of online media, because of social media, it was able to be circulated to so many people. So, and that is a statement which was written entirely by the victim. It's the victim's accounts of the assault and the aftermath, the impact it's had on her life. And the fact you were able to have 30 million people read it and gain a better understanding of the lived reality of sexual violence is something that would not have happened 20 years ago, because you never would have had a print newspaper run it. So I think with social media, people are finding it easier to connect with each other. They're also able to, you know, to bring to light these stories from different angles from the survivor's point of view, which probably wouldn't have been honored in the mainstream media in the same way, and still isn't. You know, if you look at the mainstream media coverage of key cases, they're really only interested in celebrity cases, for example, or maybe cases that blow up through social media. But there is, again, this strange selection that happens in terms of, or, you know, or stranger rape cases, right? But there's a strange selection of the cases which the mainstream media decides to cover, and social media is starting to unearth the more kind of real experience for a lot of survivors.
Is there still too hard a line, Susan Mullen? I mean, is it still too much of where somebody says, this is what happened to me, and another person would say, well, but you're dating him, so it can't be a rape?
You mean the minimalization or
yes.
the lack of belief?
Either one.
Yeah. I mean, this is when we talked about those barriers to reporting and people coming forward. This is, at the root of a lot of that is the kinds of questions as a survivor who discloses that you get asked, the kind of disbelief that you're met with. And even when we look at juries, sometimes we know the dynamics of juries. For example, women on juries often will look at the survivor and be thinking in their head, well, I don't want to admit that something like this could happen to me, so I'm going to find fault with something that she did so that I can somehow feel safer myself. So I never would have done X, Y, or Z, so I'm safe. So this sense of trying to figure out, why it happened to somebody and how can we assign them blame so that we feel safer exists. And I think also we're seeing that people have a really hard time admitting that somebody that they think that they know could commit a crime like this, right? So the instant, there's no way he would have done that, I know him, kind of aspect to cases can be really make it very difficult for survivors to speak out.
B.B. Beltran, if all the things that need to happen, ultimately we'll get a sense that there is more sexual assault going on because people will report it more freely. Is that a logical consequence?
I don't know that there's more sexual assault going on. I feel like there's always been sexual assault going on.
But what I'm saying is we'll get a sense that there's more of it because more people will report it.
Yes, I hope so. I hope so. I mean, that's the only way that we're really going to know how often it's happening, although we can, as agencies like SAS and Jackson County SART, we have folks that we work with all the time so who don't report. So I think that there has to be a combination of data. It can't just be like reporting in a formal fashion to law enforcement. It has to also be folks who self-identify and seek support at agencies like SAS and Jackson County SART. I hope so. I hope that survivors know about SAS and Jackson County SART and agencies like us and reach out.
And Winnie Lee, I want to finish up with you and ask about the Clear Lines Festival, which was the UK's first ever festival that addressed sexual assault and consent through arts and discussion. Is it going to be back this year?
Yeah, well, we ran a second edition of it. It started in 2015. I was in the middle of writing Dark Chapter, which writing a novel is very, solitary activity. So I realized, well, actually, there's so many other survivors out there and activists doing this work. I wanted to start at the festival. So we had that in 2015. There was a second edition in 2017, and actually there are plans to bring it to the United States. So I'm speaking to a few people about an East Coast and hopefully a West Coast edition. But the festival was, founded to try to create a space that was inclusive and welcoming for people to come and engage with stories and experiences of sexual assault through the arts. Because, if you have a conference or if you have kind of a more sort of formal way of approaching it, people often are so intimidated by this issue that they might, run away. But at the same time, if you tell a story around sexual abuse through, through theater or through literature or through music or, even through stand-up comedy in some ways, that's a more approachable way. And so we wanted to sort of engage with people and not have them be so scared and also at the same time celebrate the potential for survivors to create art about their experiences and to kind of change that narrative around sexual assault and abuse.
All right. Winnie Lee's novel is called Dark Chapter. Susan Mullins, Executive Director of Jackson County SART. B.B. Beltran runs SAS Lane. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. That'll do it for the Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley with Patrick Fitzsimmons. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.